You are listening to the Punk News Podcast, episode 499, which means next episode, the exact next episode, is 500. No bullshitting this time. We're not going to do any of that crazy shit where we, you know, pat it out. Right, John? Right?
Yeah, 500 is next week. Count on it, people. We've got a lot planned. It's going to be awesome. 500 next week. Be here.
Right. No. No fooling, no screwing around this time. For real, there's not going to be any of that 0.99999 horse shit. So here you go. We'll be back. All right, well, this is the Punk News Podcast. I'm Adam White, holed up in my basement here in Niagara Falls, Ontario, hiding from the wind and the sun and the horrible virus and, I don't know, judgment of the internet and everything else that I'm trying to hide from. Joining me on tonight's show, Mr. John Gentile out of some post-apocalyptic hellhole. Hi, John.
Man. Everybody's in a post-apocalyptic hellhole. It's been crazy. The year's been crazy. But it can always get worse, and it can always get better. So let's hope it gets better.
Also,
you're here.
Yeah, that's the voice of Hallie Bullitt in I don't know, what, the mountains? Is that you're hiding in the mountains, right?
Oh, my God, Adam, I finally escaped the mountains, dude. I got to actually move to my new place in New Jersey. So yeah, it's great. It's a COVID saga that, you know, obviously there are many things about COVID that are still ongoing, but this is one COVID related saga that I have been able to, like, you know, tie up with a little neat bow. It's done for me. I'm moved into my home.
Were you and your family, like you said, you escaped the mountains? Were you guys like flying out on like a jury rig, which is what I'm looking for, like a beach cruiser? You know what I mean? And like people are like shooting at you, and you're like shooting back, and you're like, "We gotta get out of the mountains!" And like there's like a big explosion behind you. Is that what happened?
That's a little bit more like what it felt like when we left New York City when all of this started going down and lockdown was happening. That's a little bit more what it felt like. No, leaving the mountains was very peaceful, and we were just grateful not to have to be just like in a weird like limbo lockdown in a home that's not our home and whatever. Yeah.
Oh, congratulations on that.
Thanks. Doing good.
Some semblance of normalcy, I guess. Although it's weird, though, yeah. Because you never get to return to the home that you left.
Oh, yeah.
When the virus started, right? So.
Yeah. No, my apartment that I love, I fled basically in the middle of the night because of COVID. And, like, I'll never go back there. Also, you know, whatever, not to get too grim, but like we don't regret the decision because we found out that 4 people died in our apartment building.
Jesus.
So that situation was real, and I'm glad that we took it seriously and that we got out.
Hallie, I don't believe it because my completely sane cousin is posting meme after meme about how COVID-19 doesn't exist. And so I don't believe you. I'm sorry. I just don't believe you.
Unbelievable. I don't know. Maybe I can bring you there and have someone cough on you.
What is with these people that are like saying it's all big lie? Like, what is that?
It's the ultimate white privilege. That's what it is, you know, because it's affecting people of color and poor people more. And so, you know, it's the worst right now example of like just clueless white privilege that I can think of, you know.
It has made the sections of the internet that are populated by my wife and I, and like our you know, aunts and uncles and you know, older cousins, and all these people that are in our lives that at some point we connected with on Facebook and whatever, because, well, of course they're family, you'd connect with them. Why would you deny connecting with those people? And then this happens, then you realize like they're all fucking crazy, and we just can't. We can't be there. We can't be on the internet interacting with these people and their theories. Their theories.
Listen. We're going to spice it up and cheer up in a second. But I had a thought, and maybe you two can tell me. I was, if Mr. Rogers was still around, I'm sure he'd say, like, no, these things are not okay. Or you know what I mean? Like, would the powers that be that are obviously anti Mr. Rogers' central ethos, would they say, you know what, Mr. Rogers is right? Or would they seek to demonize Mr. Rogers? You know what I mean?
That's a good question. It does seem that anybody that disagrees with, I don't know, like the Fox News agenda is like, is kind of immediately made to be the enemy. So yeah, maybe Mr. Rogers would be the enemy. I don't know.
It's like, what is it? Like the unstoppable object versus the immovable force. Like on one side, you have people that kowtow to whatever a certain person says, but like no one can disagree with Mr. Rogers. Like his truths are so fundamental. You're like, damn, Mr. Rogers, that is so true. And you make me want to be a better person just by talking about things. You know what I mean? Like sometimes I'm like, why can't I be as pure as Mr. Rogers? And I know I can't. You know what I mean? But like, would they attack such a sacred individual, such a beautiful person? Would they? I don't know.
I'll never know.
What I think that this whole experience is really driving home for me, just from a number of for a number of reasons, is that I need to be way less on the internet than I thought I needed to be, and the amount to which I can limit my interaction with basically anyone for any reason is better for my mental health. And that flies like completely contrary to most of my projects because they happen to be on the internet. So I'm trying to figure out how to strike that balance where I can, you know, do music things on websites and write my newsletter and everything else, but not be on the internet at the same time, which is where the source of all the information for all of those endeavors comes from. So it is it's a challenge. The ideal here is that I somehow become really independently wealthy and I can like hire a person to go out onto the internet, find me the things that I write about, and like put them in a paper inbox on a big oak bureau in a library that I build. And then I just work with that and then they can go type it up. I don't have to go on the internet anymore. That's the plan.
Well, Lincoln, speaking of typing things up, you can always type things up to us and we will check them out. You can always just add podcast@punknews.org. We got some good mail this week from you. And here is a letter that we got from you. Oh, man, I lost my thing here. But it's always good mail, and we always like hearing from you.
You had a tasty seg there, like a perfect little seg, and then you lost the actual letter.
Well, listen, Adam, I'm just trying to tell the people what they want to hear, and here's what they want to hear. This is from Kyle. Kyle, this is what Kyle says. What's poppin', Punk News Pod? Kyle from Madison, Wisconsin here, listener since episode 1. Record collecting question. I wanted to hear the crew's thoughts on test presses. My thoughts are, I keep saying I'm not going to go after any, and then I stumble into a good deal on one. I think they are cool to own because it's the most limited copy, but they just end up sitting on my shelf and they look unappealing. To be honest, they don't even get many likes on Instagram. I think these days, the more coveted thing to own are the record release variants. People rarely part with those records, and they usually have special art and hand numbered or are signed. Curious as to what you guys think. From Kyle.
There is a opportunity with test presses that I don't feel like I've seen as many artists take. And whenever I do see them take it, it seems like a great idea. So what that is that you do have this kind of like rare copy of the record floating around. And like, now what's the quantity usually of like the test presses you would get for something? Is it like,
That's the thing now is now record labels, to their credit, realize the value of test presses. So they'll make sometimes they'll do 50 or 100 of them, in which case it's not even really a test press.
So I'm talking about way, 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 way less than that. So let's say in the 10 to 15 copies of something like that, right? So if you've got one of those kinds of runs of test presses floating around, it does give you the opportunity to do something like basically handmade with them, right? Like do something unique with each of those copies and then get them out there. So this just popped up last week during the big Bandcamp sale. So we just passed, last weekend was the first, the first Friday of the month? Are those the Bandcamp Fridays, right? So Bandcamp waived all their artist fees, but then that kind of coincided with the, all the Black Lives Matter fundraising that was happening. So all these bands were like running out and trying to find ways to raise money on that day in particular. So one of my favorite bands, Tough Age out of Toronto, they had gone and taken a bunch of test presses for Shame, which is the record they had come out in 2017, 2018 on Mint. And they like created like handmade collage covers for each of the press, for like each copy of the press that they had. And then they sold those off on, you know, for like whatever, like the five or six of them they had, they sold those off on Bandcamp at like a pay what you want to make a donation type deal. And those got snatched up in like a few minutes, but they were all like, all of them were like completely unique and then completely like hand created by the band. And like, that was like a really good use of it, because like, not only do you have, you know, this perfectly fine working copy of the record that happens to be pretty unique, but now it's super unique because someone went and did something by hand with it. That to me is a little bit more interesting than just the, you know, here's a sleeve where we've, you know, written in Sharpie the name of the record on it for you if we were nice. And, you know, I've got a handful of those around. I'm glad that I have them, but it's, I feel like for the records I care maybe a little bit less about from an emotional standpoint, yeah, they're not as appealing an object floating around than not. Like, that same label sent me a test press of the record that just came out from a band called Woolworm. They had a record called Awe that came out in late last year. And the record is great. And they sent it to me, you know, because I was writing about the band because I really liked them. And it felt very good to get it. It was like a nice gift. But on the other hand, I've got a test press of one of the last Planes Mistaken for Stars records that I feel that No Idea sent me for, or some, or either the band or No Idea. I don't know. Like, I like that band, don't get me wrong, but I don't have any kind of personal working relationship with anyone involved in that band. And it just sort of showed up one day in the mail, which was, again, nice, but now it's just a thing that every time I run into it on my rack, I'm like, what is this again? And I was like, oh, it's that Planes record that just now has no label. John, what do you think?
If I come across one, I'll pick it up if it's a reasonable price, but I'm not going to dish out like crazy money to buy one. To a degree, before test presses were collector's items, they were kind of more hallowed. And then, oh, I've got, you know, the Integrity test press for this record, or I've got this Dwarf test press for that. But now, like, people, they tend to be manufactured as collector's items. And so, to me, I mean, it's just a record. There's nothing. I'm more of a music collector than I am a record collector, in that, like, I want cool music, not necessarily and I'm really not interested in, like, a color press of a certain record. I prefer black. I mean, I'll get the rarer one if it's just the rarer one, if it's, like, the same price. But I'm not that into collecting test presses. I've got some cool ones. My favorite ones are, I've got some Integrity ones with hand-drawn covers, which are pretty cool.
Yeah.
Other than that, like, just a white label thing, if I come across it and it's a cheap price, I'll pick it up if it's a record I really like. But I'm not going to go – I'm not going to pay more for one than what I could hypothetically sell it for down the road. And most test presses usually sell for about what they're worth, unless it's like, as a side note, is crate diggers out there like myself, at garage sales, you'll often find test presses for like house music and freestyle music and dance music. And sometimes those can go for a crazy amount of money, because dance collectors and house collectors, and especially freestyle collectors, will spend a lot of money for these rare things. And you listen to me and you're like, what's the big deal about this? So just FYI. Halle Bullet, test presses. What's the style?
They're so cool. And yet I can't claim to be part of that cool. I don't even know where my own test presses are for my own records. It's just like, I understand like it conceptually that they're a cool thing, but I've just like never actually like invested in caring about it. I don't know why.
Fair enough. This letter is from Dubby, and here's what Dubby has to say. Here we go. Oh, come on. Here we go. This is from Dubby. Punk News Podcast, what's the craziest or most unexpected or most shocking thing that you've seen happen in punk? Maybe it was at a show or just an event in general. Maybe it was a weird record release. I want to go to live shows again. What's the most unexpected thing you've seen? From Dubby. Well, I'll go.
You go.
I'll do the
thing that immediately jumped into my head is bad, and I don't know if I should, but you go.
Yeah, well, I'm going to do a funny one and then a bad one. I don't know if this is the most shocking things, but one time I saw Lee Scratch Perry at Moe's Alley in Santa Cruz, probably my favorite venue in the world. It's not on the beach, but it feels like it's on the beach because it's near the beach. And they do a lot of reggae there, and it is just freaking awesome. And anyways, one time I saw Lee Scratch Perry there. He didn't even start to like – they always start shows super late at Moe's Alley, and it was like a Tuesday night. And it didn't even start till like 11 p.m. And there was like three opening acts and they all played for like an hour. Not really, but it felt that way. And so Lee Perry comes out at like 1:15. So you're like, all right, he's just going to do like an hour or something. He does literally like a 2.5 hour show. And it was getting crazier and crazier. Not in the violent sense, but there was no security because you really don't need them. But the Santa Cruz audience was like high as hell. And somebody must have brought some weird acid or something because there was like people – Like people were totally tripping out, and they were getting on stage, and like no one like kind of stopped. Like at a punk show, it's cool to get on stage. At a reggae show, kind of not as cool. But like no one was stopping him, and I thought like the band was going to get pissed off. But like Lee Perry thought it was great, and there was this one guy that was must have been tripping on something crazy. He's like swimming on the stage. Like I don't even know how. Like it looked like he was backstroking. But there's no water there. Like, I don't know how. Like, you try and lay down and backstroke and see if you move. You won't. But this guy was, like, backstroking and swimming across the stage. And he goes under Lee Scratch Perry's legs, which he just – it was weird. Then he gets up and he starts, like, touching – like, Lee Scratch Perry has a – I don't know what – it's a machine that makes sounds when you hit it. Not a keyboard. Like a sampler, I guess they call it. Yeah. And he starts playing with it. And it is a big no-no. Not to touch a musician's like the all right. So if you're on stage, whatever, but don't touch like the equipment. This guy's like touching the equipment and making noises, and like no one seemed. I'm standing looking at him. I'm like, who's going to stop this guy? And like no one cared. And Lee Perry thought it was like the greatest thing ever. And so like they're all like Lee Perry. They're just like jamming. Lee Perry's being like crazy as he always is. And then the guy comes over and kisses Lee Perry on the cheek, which is like, if you're Jamaican, that is not cool. You know, and the guy was like really, really, everybody there is really, really high. And Lee Perry talks in a very, very heavy Jamaican patois. Even other Jamaicans say he talks in that. Like I was watching an interview with Larry McDonald, who drums in Lee Perry, Obonga, this percussion. And he even says, you know, like Scratch. Well, I won't try to effectuate a Jamaican accent, but he's like Scratch speaks in a really heavy patois. So Lee Perry is cursing at this guy. He's calling him a mother effer. He's calling him a bombo clot. Like he's saying, you blah, blah, blah. Like he's like, I've seen him angry a couple of times. He was furious, right? But the guy and the audience was so high, everyone's like, sing it, Scratch. Say it. Ja, Rastafari, Irie, Irie. And he's like cursing this guy out, calling him like a dirty MFer. And like this guy has no idea. And he's like, yes, yes, Ja Rastafari. And it's like, it's clear the guy like doesn't know anything about like Jamaican music, really, you know? And so like Perry was furious and he like just like leaves the stage and the band just kind of like looks at each other and just kind of like walks away. And the guy's like, Ja Rastafari. And everyone's like, that was so great. That was so great. And I'm like, I mean, I was just me. So I don't like talk to anybody, but I'm like, he was totally just cursing you all out and calling you dipshit. You know, it's like, but they didn't know, you know? So that's my funny one. I won't say my sad one because it's sad. So that's my funny one.
I'm kind of with you guys. Like, I feel like I have a lot that are like just bad or sad, although interesting, but I'll leave those aside. I think like the most joyous, bizarre thing I ever saw at a show was like a rockabilly garage lineup that was in like some random bar. We had driven up to like, I don't know why. I lived in the East Village. There were like good shows happening around me all the time, but we drove up to some random bar in like New Rochelle, which is like, you know, if you don't know New York, it's just like up and out of the city. It's like kind of the somewhere between like the city and the suburbs. And there are all these like, yeah, these garage and like rockabilly bands playing. And a guy showed up and he had his own like vibes. Isn't that what that's called? It's like a big, like big, way bigger than a xylophone. And like you play with it, like what they play in like Praising the Brains, right?
Yeah,
he had his own and he marched right up to the front of the stage and put his instrument on the front of the stage and then just proceeded to like live his life, like rock out as hard as he possibly could to like every single song. And the thing was like, you know, it wasn't mic'd, so you couldn't hear it. So he wasn't really disturbing anybody. So the bands just like let him do it. Like no one could hear what he was playing, but he was like having the time of his life and it was like kind of amazing. And yeah, that's probably the most positive, interesting thing I've seen happen at a show.
Oh, he wasn't in the band. He was just some guy.
Sorry, I was not clear. He was just some guy.
That's awesome. That is awesome.
His audience, but he put his instrument up on the front of the stage so that it was like at the right level for him to play it from the audience. And then he just played along to every band.
That is awesome.
You see, the fun thing is that, like everything I think of keeps coming back to either something that is like severely not social distanced given the current climate. And maybe that's why like I'm longing for things like this. I went up to this music festival that was in like north Quebec a few years ago, and like a 7-hour drive north of Montreal. Like it was far. I barely spoke the language and I didn't know most of the bands that were playing it, but like I was there covering it. And there were a few acts that I went to see because like I knew that they were popular within the context of the Quebec music scene, which is super insular. Like you may as well be talking about like the fact that they're still Canadian doesn't really matter too much. Like you may as well be talking about like, you know, like French, like bands in France playing to audiences in France, and you know, the obliviousness that you would have to that as a North American person is really the same obliviousness that we have as to like what's going on in Quebec half the time. And so there are bands that I knew were like popular pop punk bands or whatever within Quebec, but I didn't really know anything about them or like what kind of crowd they drew or anything like that. But I remember going in to see there's a band from somewhere there called Le Dale Havlerchuk. And they're, you know, I knew one goofy single that they had that I found on YouTube when I was doing my research before I went up there. But I had no idea, like, if anyone actually cared about this band or anything like that. And I go into the venue where they're playing, and it is it's like a sea. There had to been like thousands. It felt like there were thousands. I'm sure there wasn't, but it felt like there were thousands of people packed into this little room. And this band is just on stage playing these pop punk songs or whatever. But the crowd is acting like it was like the crowd at a fucking Foo Fighters show or something like that. Like it was this like the biggest thing for everyone in the room that this band was on stage. And it may have just been the remoteness of the area. Like this festival happens in a little copper mining town that's up there, and it must draw like every human being from any of the surrounding villages and everything like that into the town because there's nothing else going on like this otherwise. And just like being there, fly on the wall, not speaking the language, and just watching this whole room of people just go absolutely insane for this rock band was just so surreal to me because I had no context. Like it wasn't a band where I knew what was going on outside of one song, and just seeing that level of joyousness was just nuts. And that is a very pure answer for what I was going to say, because the immediate thing that popped into my head where they were like, what's a crazy thing that happened at the show, where I was like, oh, we were standing around before a Dillinger Four show once and Patty pulled his dick out. But I think that is both A, less appropriate nowadays than perhaps it was a few years ago, and B, I'm pretty sure a totally common occurrence at a Dillinger Four show and not at all a unique story to tell. But yeah.
I was at a Dillinger Four show where Patty was throwing up in a bucket next to him the entire time.
Like on stage?
on stage.
We were at that was one of the first. I have a throw up story here. Actually, this is just something that really struck me as a young person. So really early days of punk news, we used to go up to Toronto and get into various shows that like Fat Bands were putting on because we were really good with Fat at that point. And there was an Against Me show that was at, I think, the Opera House in Toronto, and they were playing with Smoker Fire, I guess, was opening for them. And we were standing at the side of the stage and watching them, and Smoker Fire finishes their set. And the singer, whose name I forget, he like walks off stage, this big triumphant rock show that he did. And as soon as he is like out of shot of the like crowd, like just hurls into a bucket. And we were all standing there next to him, like, and the bucket. And we're just like, ah, like that's not what we expected to happen immediately upon this. And it was just that, like, he was just on there and going hard, and just like, you know, if you're up there screaming, it does things to your body that maybe you don't realize. And for him, it was just like that's it. I'm gonna hurl. It was not something we expected. Anyways, all my stories about this are stupid. I really want to go to shows.
Yeah.
Well, you can always reach us at podcast@punknews.org. SummerSlam 4 is postponed, sadly, but you got to do what you got to do. I'll let you guys know what's going to happen. We're probably going to do some kind of SummerSlam in fall or winter, but that's what's happening right now. You can always reach us at podcast@punknews.org. Who wants to play a song?
I'll go first here because I have a bunch that are just sitting around. So here's a band. They're a three-piece out of Toronto called Pacer. They've had a handful of really cool, super hooky singles that they've put out in the past, like over the past few months. And they were all set to go, you know, do the big release show, put out their first EP, really, really, really get out there and start to hit it. And they've got like potential given their sound, where like they could, you know, you could see them out there on the road one day playing with like the bands that have elevated out of that scene. You know, you could see them on stage with, you know, Pew 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 or with Pup or with the Dirty Mill or the Flatliners. Like they would have worked with any of that kind of context. But then, you know, coronavirus happened and their release show was canned, and they're just sitting there, you know, waiting like the rest of us. So this is the last single that they put out before everything got locked down. So this song is called Everlaster. It's from a band called Pacer. And I know there's like a million bands called Pacer, but this is the Pacer that happens to be in Toronto if you're looking them up. There you go.
So good, it's like time is masturbating. The phone does feel was in your kiss.
That was Pacer out of Toronto. We're going to talk about some news, some stuff that happened.
Honestly, Adam, we got some Nazi stories to talk about first.
Oh, shit. We forgot the Nazis. We forgot the Nazis. Well, all right. Fuck the rest of this news.
If only we could truly forget the Nazis.
Okay. Yeah, all right.
I've got an interesting Nazi story. Oh, go ahead, Adam.
No, I was going to say, I'm going to sit back and let the Nazi stories happen. This is all I want.
So I've got an interesting Nazi story, and Howe's got an interesting Nazi story, and it's a fitting time to tell this more than ever. This happened to me about 8 months ago or so. So I've got a friend, and we'll just call him Jim, and Jim is married to, say, we'll say Clara. And I knew Jim first, and then I knew Clara through Jim. And I'm friends with Jim, and then I became friends with Clara. So Hallie and Adam, at our age, it's weird when someone is like overly friendly towards you, like they want to be like friends. It's like, don't you already have friends? Like, why are you actively looking for new friends? But whatever.
Yeah.
So the thing, Claire's a nice person. She's friendly, and she's like, are you going to the show? I'll meet you there, whatever. You know, and I'm like, all right, that's fine, whatever. So like, Claire's like, you're really trying to be friends with me, you know what I mean? But I'll put an asterisk here. Like, even though I'm a guy and she's a girl, strictly platonic. No vibes in that context whatsoever. That's not part of the story. You know what I mean? And she's married, but I mean, like that's not the angle of the story. So, anyways, I was downtown and I think I put like on Facebook or something, like, oh, I just saw, I don't know, I don't even remember who it was, like Sloppy Seconds. It wasn't Sloppy Seconds. And then Claire was like, oh, you're downtown, you know, let's hang out. I'm like, all right. So she's like, come over to my place and hang out. So I go over to the place and we're like just hanging out and talking. And real, I get there and it's weird because it's like Claire's just like there and like doesn't have anything to talk about. And I'm like, oh, what's going on? And she's like, you know, not much. I'm like, that's cool. And Clara's a friendly person. I'm like, well, let's check out your record collection. Because like myself, Clara is a big record collector. I'm a huge record collector. Clara's an even bigger record collector than I am. So I'm like flipping through Clara's collection. And she's got some killer stuff. I mean, she's got like, I don't know, original Clash records. But even deeper than that, like original Flipper records. Original Germs records. A lot of cool old school stuff. And I'm flipping. I'm like, wow, a lot of cool stuff here. A lot of cool stuff. And the collection is also what I would say manicured. My collection, it's got some junk in it I just picked up and threw on the shelves. Clara's collection, bulletproof. Like, just good stuff after. No junk at all, right? I'm flipping through, right? And I come to a section, and it's a screwdriver record. I'm like, all right. So I keep flipping, right? Then it's like, what's that band? All Out Attack or whatever? I'm like, oh. I keep flipping, and Clara, like, literally has, like, 100 to 200 White Power records, and I'm like, what is going on here? You know what I mean? And so, honestly, if they had, like, one or two, you could say, well, you know, maybe somehow they came across it, and it just, you know, but, this, and Clara's not her real name, obviously. I'm not using real names here, but I'm like, holy shit! You know, and like it's not easy to get White Power records, especially now, because you can't buy them off eBay or Discogs. So you have to like go to like specialty shops and kind of get them through like a black market, really. And they're not cheap. They're like super expensive. So to have a massive White Power collection, you have to intend to get a massive White Power collection. And so I gave Clara the Death in June test. And Adam, we've talked about Death in June before. Hallie, are you familiar with Death in June?
No.
So Death in June is this whacked out guy. He was in a band called Crisis. And every single song by Crisis is about how much they hate Nazis. They broke up. One of the two main guys formed Death in June. Death in June has used Nazi imagery in their art before. But the question is, are they subverting it or are they not? And you can say, well, that's in poor taste. However, the guy is extremely openly gay. So how can he be extremely openly gay and be a Nazi? It doesn't make any sense. But on the other hand, why does he flirt with his imagery? And why doesn't he ever like define what his position actually is? So he's a very spooky guy, you know, and it's unclear. And the real answer is he's probably kind of nutty is the real answer. But who knows? You know, so I gave Clara the Death in June test. I'd be like, oh, yeah, Death in June. You know, everyone thinks that Douglas P. is a Nazi, but I don't think he's a Nazi because he's gay. How could he be a Nazi if he's gay? And Clara failed the Death in June test by being quiet and seemingly being annoyed. Not that I was saying that Douglas P. might be a Nazi, but saying that he was gay, you see. And so I'm like, holy shit. You know what I mean? Like, I would have never have guessed that this person would have like white power music. You know what I mean? And so like I think like I didn't want to be like weird about it. Like, I didn't want to like start a fight over it. What am I going to, you know what I mean? So I'm like, oh yeah, yeah. I'm just like, well, I gotta be going. And then Clara's like, you know, I just listen to that as entertainment. It's just entertainment. That's all it is. Just entertainment. It doesn't mean anything. It's just entertainment. Like anything. I'm like, all right. You know, and then like, that's weird, right? I mean, that's like totally weird.
It's so weird to say it's just entertainment. Who's buying that? Like, either own it or what? That is such a strange story. I'm so sorry that happened to you. That's so awkward. It's like,
the weird part is, yeah. And honestly, it is weird because I had I didn't like run away from them, but I definitely haven't hung out with either of them since. You know what I mean? And the weird thing is her husband like loves black music. You know, that's weird.
I mean,
that's weird, right? That's weird. Man. What do you do in that situation? Do you say, Clara, you should not listen to this? Or do you just say, Clara's going to do what Clara's going to do and I got to do what I got to do?
You excuse yourself and run away.
Run away.
Do you know how hard it is to get those records? It's like really, really hard to get those records. Well, so you have to put a lot.
It either means one of two things, right? Either you bought like a whole crate of records innocently at someone's garage sale, and you know all this shit happened to in one ill-conceived swoop ended up on your shelf, or you were kind of like hunting and pecking around the fucking dark web to find them, and that shows more intent. Than not, right?
But the rest of the collection was extremely manicured, you know?
I mean, if that winds up in your house by accident, then you throw it out like so much garbage, you know? It's like, oh, I don't know. It sounds more like an acquired, like a sought after and acquired collection, in which case, like, I don't know, that's, you really want to be entertained in a very specific way, I guess, if it's just entertainment.
I would say is like I Armando, who used to write for Punk News and is still friendly with Punk News. He lives out in California. Like, I would see on Facebook, he's like, Nazi skinhead showed up at the show tonight. I can't believe it. Well, here we go again. And I'm like, man, I've been to a lot of shows. I don't think I've ever seen a Nazi skinhead like out in the open, you know? But then this makes me wonder, like, maybe how prevalent is this stuff? You know what I mean? Like, maybe it's way more prevalent than I think it is.
I think that's what we're realizing, right?
Yeah, yeah. So, Hallie, what's your humorous Nazi story?
Oh, my God. You guys, it was like the day, it was a day or two after that mess in Charlottesville. So, like, there had just been this neo-Nazi rally. I think it was the first time that a lot of us had to really truly wake up to the fact that racism is like alive and well in America. It was so shocking. And, you know, talk about white privilege. I like woke up the next day and I put on this Dead Kennedys shirt that I have that has an image of an American flag on it. And of course, like all these neo-Nazi protesters had been like waving the flag, you know. Also, sidebar, why do these idiots get to have the American flag as their thing? Like, I say, like, punks, liberals, like, fucking decent people, I say we need to take this fucking flag back. Sorry for the cursing. That's my sidebar. Why do they get to have the flag as, like, that? Why is that? I could go on and on. Sorry. So, anyhow, so here I am, naive Hallie, walking down the streets of New York City the day after this rally in Charlottesville, and everyone is so upset, and a black man full on elbowed me in the face, elbowed me, like knocked my glasses off.
Damn.
Like, knocked, I mean, clocked me, you guys, like clocked me. And I was like so shocked. I didn't know what had happened. And then a door guy that saw it happen was like, yo, man, because like I think at first I was like trying to tell myself maybe he had just run into me by accident. I was like, no, man, he just hit you. That was intentional. And then I really thought about it. I was so upset. I was like, why in the world would someone do that to me? And then I looked down and I was like, oh, yeah, I think I just got mistaken for like, I don't know, like a Charlottesville rally, like sympathizer or something. It was just it's probably like hard right now to imagine, like, but it was like in that moment I was like, oh, that's what it was. Like, no, what kind of clueless dummy would be wearing a freaking shirt with an American flag on it today when people are upset and racial tensions are so high and that the flag has come so specifically to mean like bad things to people of color. It's just come to mean really bad things, you know?
That doesn't make it okay for that person to do that to you. That is totally unacceptable.
It was totally unacceptable. And yet, I don't know, somehow in that moment, I was just like, meh, oh, well, like, I should have been smarter. I should have like dressed with more sympathy today, I guess. Or just been
well, I can't tell you how to feel, but I don't think you did anything wrong. I don't think you should feel as I should have done something. You know, I think that's violence in any circumstances kind of violence is acceptable to prevent when someone else is being hurt, in my opinion, you know? So I think that's totally unacceptable and is just terrible.
No, you're absolutely right. No, absolutely unacceptable. That being said, like, you know, I'm not like, oh, I brought it on myself, but I definitely could have made different decisions that day that maybe would have led to that maybe not happening to me.
It's one of those things where like, if you're not aware of the, like, let's say you weren't aware of the particularities of punkers or anything like that, right? So Dead Kennedys doesn't mean anything to you in particular. But if you were to, say, encounter a Dead Kennedys shirt, you know, and especially one that had an American flag on it, like from an imagery standpoint, like the Dead Kennedys logo is like, you know, it's hard, it's angular. I can totally see why someone could go and look at that and go like, oh, is that some neo-Nazi symbol? Like if you wouldn't know, if you didn't know, like it has that I don't know what the right design term is it for here, but like it seems it references that like Iron Cross kind of style, you know, angles and things like that. So I could totally see, like, completely out of context, not that it justifies anything, but like someone looking at that and being like, hey, is that one of them?
But I'm sitting there thinking, like, Dead Kennedys, like, yeah, everybody knows this is subversive. It's like, no, they don't. No, they don't. Not everybody knows
that. You know what? I remember, like, when I was a teenager and I was, like, wearing Crossbuster shirts around that, like, I had seriously strange conversations with people every once in a while where about like, not only, like, what it meant, but, like, what it meant from, like, both sides of it. Like, are they like, is this some sort of Christian thing? And then B, is this some sort of like hatefully anti-Christian thing? And then to be like, no, it's a band. And yeah, right. And to try to like get into that with people is odd. Yeah. If they have no context at all. Now we mentioned, see, this is a nice segue here. You mentioned Crisis, John, when you were talking about, your test there that you did. Well, there's crisis news. There is crisis news. So a few weeks ago, the anarcho-punks Crisis reformed with founding member Tony Wakeford, along with Clive Giblin, Lloyd James, and Aurora Lee. In 2018, they released a limited edition live CD called Paris 18. Now, the band is planning to release new studio material altogether. So this thing's going to be called Escalator. It is a 12-inch EP. It's out in either in the late summer or the early fall. And it's going to be the band's first album of studio material since 1982's Holocaust EP. So old. Now, after which the band, after that Holocaust EP came out, the band splintered into several different groups, including Wakeford's long running Soul Invictus. But yeah, so there's going to be new material from the anarcho-punk group Crisis nearly 40 years after the first one. John, what do you have to say about this?
Well, as Douglas P is not in the current form of Crisis, so we don't have that issue. Tony Wakeford's got his own issues. If you haven't checked out the Crisis, and that's a question, can a later days artist poison the earlier stuff? There's only like 14 original Crisis songs, and they're all amazing. There's a CD that has them all on it, and they are killer. And every single song is about how much they hate Nazis. And then you got Douglas P afterward being weird, you know? Does Douglas P being weird later on poison Crisis when they're clearly explicitly anti-Nazi? The other thing about this is this really Crisis? Not really, because it's just Tony Wakeford and three other people. So it's really Soul Invictus. That being said, I'm excited to check it out because Crisis is amazing. The other thing is, you know, some people, I'm not trying to be a dick here, but some people look cool when they get older. You know, Nick Cave looks cool. Iggy Pop looks cool as hell. You know, even John Lydon looks cool, you know, but I've only seen picture of Tony Wakeford from like 1978, and I saw a recent picture of him, and honestly, it looks like he just got out of the steampunk convention. He's got the top hat on and the belt buckles, and I'm not trying to be a dick, that's your thing, that's cool, but it's like in my mind, like Crisis is like this very severe band, like Crisis. You know, we're extreme, we're severe, we're cold, you know. And you see this guy's like, oh, man, my half-elf, half-goblin just leveled up. you know what I mean?
You weren't expecting whimsy from the guy.
Right. Like, I kind of didn't want to see that. And so that's the question is, the question is, can a later-day artist poison their older work? And also, can sometimes your mind not knowing is better than your mind knowing?
People get old, right? I mean, you can't.
Yeah, it's not his fault. It's not his fault.
Like
he was wearing a top hat.
Yeah,
Adam,
you don't grow the top hat, right? So that's a that is something you have willfully decided upon. Like, do you remember when everyone was shitting on John Lydon during the last Pill tour because I don't know, he was like more.
It happens, than, man.
Yeah, like
it happens, dude.
Like, what's like? How old is he? He's in what? He's in his. Is he in his 70s or his 60s? Like, he's...
No, he's like 64.
Right, so... It does not bother me one way or the other that a 64-year-old is potentially heavier than when they were, like, a poor 20-year-old. So, you know, if they're going to be old, they can be old. Being old and then choosing to don a top hat, though, is... Yeah, I don't know. That's not a... I can't justify that one. Hallie, do you have any Crisis thoughts, or do we roll forward here?
I don't have any Crisis thoughts because I've moved on to I think the last time I saw John Lydon, like an image of him was like he not only looked like a little chubby, which is fine, you get older, but he also was like wearing a dashiki or something that seems maybe like not okay for a white guy to be wearing. So I don't know. I've just got that image now in my brain, and I'm speechless about all other subjects.
poor John Lydon. I wish people would leave him alone.
Yo, listen, John Lydon is the man. I mean, he really is. I mean,
he is. Yeah.
Do you know what John Lydon is doing right now? He is being the personal caretaker for his wife and his brother-in-law, who both have dementia.
Wow.
John Lydon, it is crazy how like a lot of people talk a big game. And John Lydon has been criticized for not necessarily, I guess, expressing certain virtues. But when push comes to shove, he's doing the moral right thing, at least as to his immediate family members. I have such – I mean, listen, nobody's perfect. And he probably said some whack stuff. But, man, I mean – and I don't know him personally, but I really do have a lot of respect for John Lydon for a lot of reasons.
Yeah.
Dashiki notwithstanding.
we all, none of us are perfect, right? So we all have our faults. All right, so The 77 Montreal or Montreal 77. I'm not sure what order you say that in. Is a festival that happened last year. It was last year the first one, I think, in Montreal. They brought a bunch of like 70s ish era punk bands, and then a handful of newer punk bands in, and they played a big show. And that ain't happening this year, of course, because of obvious reasons. But what they've started to do is line up some of their, online replacement events. So the first two of these have been announced, and they are going to have the Calgary Skate Punk Veterans Belvedere play on the 25th of July, and then on August 8th, Mute is going to be celebrating their 2009 release, The Raven, by playing it in its entirety. And they're actually, the bands are playing these shows. They're live streaming them from bars in Quebec City. Now, that is maybe not too interesting, the story. The story I think that John really wanted to touch on here was that both of these live streaming shows are shows that you would pay for. So you go online and you plunk down, what is it, $16 for the Belvedere one, or I don't know, something probably similar like that for the other. And you pay to gain access to these live streams, which is something we're seeing more of crop up, but definitely wasn't the norm earlier on in isolation life, when everyone was just live streaming everything all the time. So, John, I think you wanted to talk specifically about this. Is this a thing that you would pay for? Maybe not these bands in particular, but would you pay to go to a virtual concert?
Yeah, that's the thing, is the factoid has been going on around that 90% of venues, not factoid, I guess the opinion piece that says 90% of small venues won't survive the COVID crisis, and also that live concerts might not even resume till 2021. And that might be, I don't know, that might be true. I hope it's not true, but I don't want a second wave of COVID infections, so I don't even know, to tell you the truth. That being said, it is sort of a dismal look for venues and touring acts. So we have to figure out. I think everyone wants small venues to stay alive. It's essential to the arts. So we need to figure out a solution as to how to make that happen. Is paying for, and this really goes to the artists, not the venues themselves. Is paying to watch a live stream going to keep artists running? I mean, honestly, like, I would pay to watch, like, my very favorite artists, like, here and there. I can't see myself doing that, like, on a weekly or even a monthly basis. It really just isn't quite the same. I'd much rather buy, you know, like we're talking about, like, records with different covers or something like that. So I think it's an interesting novelty, but I don't think it's a long-term fix to the current COVID crisis. I just don't see it being as equally engaging, and I don't see people with as much free media out there. I don't see people really continually doing this to support medium to small artists. Hallie, what do you think?
My gut instinct is just the same as yours. It's just, I just can't imagine myself like doing it on a regular basis. Part of the problem is just with me. I'm like that with a lot of things. Like, my husband loves basketball and he loves pro wrestling. And like, he knows that if he brings me to a live event, I will totally enjoy myself. I will pay attention. I will scream when good things happen. I will boo when bad things happen. I will eat snacks. I'll be happy. But if he tries to play that stuff for me on the TV, I totally tune out. My eyes glaze over. I just can't. But that, you know, maybe that's just me. I like can't connect to something that I really feel like is supposed to be experienced live. I just can't do it through a screen. That being said, like, I have just like moved out of New York City, and like, maybe this is like a great, maybe I'm really lucky. Maybe this is a great time for things to be happening more virtually. And maybe I should really be trying to figure out a way to embrace that. I mean, one thought that I had is that it would be really cool if like artists maybe, I don't know, like if they really started thinking about like, well, if it's not a live show, like how do we, you know, like, okay, like you think about like Talking Heads, Stop Making Sense, like that I could watch like every day, all day. That's like the most amazing thing. But because it was specifically like, it is a live concert, but it also was specifically filmed as a film. Do you know what I mean? It was like filmed with the idea in mind you were going to be watching it on a screen. And so I'm just wondering if there's like a way for artists to get really creative. Like maybe there's more stuff like that, more stuff where like you have some, you know, do you make more like music movies? Do you do more live performances that are really geared towards like specifically like finding something special about it that makes it cool to watch on screen? I don't know. I've just, but yeah, but you know, my gut reaction is like, no, I don't know if I'm going to do that. But I'd like to change my own mind, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
I'd like to experience one, because I've definitely had my share of pretty spotty, Instagram or Facebook live streams that I've witnessed in the past month or so. And were they to actually put one of these together where the paying for it sort of implied that the production values of it were going to be better, both in terms of the, you know, it's not filmed on someone's cell phone. We're not worried about it, you know, glitching out halfway. Like if they could solve those problems by the fact that it is there's some professionals that are involved in it, then I might be more open to checking a few of these things out. There's a company actually that, I don't know if either of you know, there's like an indie rock artist named Dan Mangan. And so he started a company called Sidedoor. And Sidedoor was an app that up until the COVID thing happened, that was meant to be something that people used to like self-organize house shows. So kind of you could go on, you could communicate with the artist over the app and then book your space and then sell the tickets for it and transact with the artist that way, where basically you could say like, okay, like I know you're going to be in the area. I've set up a show in my living room. There's going to be 14 people there. You've been paid for it. It's all ready to go. And it like facilitates that kind of thing. And it was supposed to be, I mean, the intention for it was going to like help facilitate this, like, you know, new way of touring that artists could embark upon or whatever. And I don't know how successful it was before that happened, but since COVID's happened, they've really pivoted into doing these paid for live shows. And from what I've heard, they're going pretty well, because there's something about it where if it's not just a Facebook live stream that like, say like X hundred people are all watching and, you know, chirping in the comments together on, but it's something that's more akin to say like a Zoom call where it's you and like a very limited amount of other people that are all paying to be there as well. There's sort of a different level of intimacy and interaction that you get than if it's just like a comment wall on Facebook or something like that. So, you know, I'd be curious to actually experience one, but that said, no one I'm particularly interested in has actually put one of those together yet. The one thing that I'm seeing more of now, as we kind of get into this world where we're at least in Ontario, we're like slightly less locked down than we were a month ago, is artists getting together and making use of some of the venues that are empty. So like the big venue near me, and by big, I mean important, like my important venue, they're trying to figure out how to pay the bills. So they've decided that, well, you know what? We have a big room with good acoustics and sound equipment in it. We're going to rent this out as like a really killer practice space for bands during the time where they can't actually bring in an audience. And I'm pretty sure that that's just like a couple steps away from, oh, let's just bring in a band to play like a full show, but we'll live stream the full show out of the venue proper, as opposed to it being, you know, some guy playing acoustically on Facebook or something like that. So, you know, in the slightly less locked down world, maybe these kind of shows would be better than what we've seen so far. I don't know. We'll have to see. But let's move on. Bob Mould, Okay, yeah, here we go. Sorry, I'm finding my notes here. So Bob Mould has released a video for the song American Crisis. It is a single taking off his upcoming record Blue Hearts, which is due September 25th on Merge. It follows up 2019's Sunshine Rock. And you can go find the video for that thing over on YouTube right now. This is Bob in angry mode, not Bob in like more placid singer-songwriter mode. And and Hallie, you mentioned you really wanted to talk about this one. So what do you think?
Yeah, I think the song is great, first of all. But I feel like this kind of falls. I don't know. Yeah, I said I wanted to talk about this and now I can't like form my words. I just like it reminded me of like, did you guys hear this like interview, or I think it was quoted all over the place, so maybe you just heard people talking about it. Like Rollins did this interview shortly after Trump was inaugurated. And he said, I have it written down. He said, "This is not a time to be dismayed. This is punk rock time. This is what Joe Strummer trained you for." And like, that's what this reminded me of, is it was like this. I mean, I'm completely dismayed that we're back here, but like, this is what punk is for. And like to see Bob Mould, like, sort of like railing against like the powers that be. And to see, like, of course, Crisis is back. Like, Crisis is back because, like, freaking Nazis are back. You know, like, there is something about this moment that I think is, like, it's cool to see an old punk like Bob Mould, you know, singing about what's happening. Again, it's sad that he has to, but it's, like, somebody's got to. And I don't know, I think, I thought it was really smart and cool. I mean, if you really, really listen to the lyrics, he's definitely drawing some connections between COVID and like the crisis in the 80s with AIDS, which was something that, you know, he says in the song that like he had friends die, and that this is like the 80s all over again, kind of. And, you know, it is, it's like, this is what happens when the government, you know, picks and chooses what facts it wants to pay attention to. This is the suffering that happens when the government decides it only wants to protect the needs and the health of certain portions of the population. And I think we all thought we were past this, but it made me feel better to watch like someone that I'm familiar with his music and I trust him, and to hear him sort of being like, can you believe this shit? Like, how are we here again? Like, we thought we had like gotten rid of this in the 80s, but here we are. I don't know. I just thought the song was smart and cool, and I've talked about it. So what did you guys think?
I enjoyed this quite a bit. And what it struck me when I was listening to it was that I am totally shamefully unfamiliar with most of Bob's post Husker Du work. And I don't even know why. I think it's just because like I was too young for Husker Du when they were first around, of course. So that was one of these bands that like I circled back to as a young adult or as a teenager or whatever and learned about. But then like once I kind of got through their catalog, I kind of like stuck a pin in it and I was like, aha, there, done. Now I'm going to go listen to, you know, The Jam or something, right? And I didn't follow where he was going. So I've spent the last hour before we started this show just playing through like the top, or at least what Apple Music decided was the top Bob Mould songs. And I'm into all of it. So I'm like, I really need to go back and actually listen to these records now because I'm into it. Well, the one thing that really struck me though, that really stuck out to me listening to that, to like the, I don't know, the most popular songs of his solo catalog were, it's incredibly clear listening to that stuff where he is playing more in a, you know, in a cleaned up alt rock mode a lot of the time than of course Husker Du sounded like. It's totally clear the lineage between what Husker Du was doing and like most of the like melodic punk bands of today, like most of those young bands, because they sound so much like middle-aged Bob Mould solo stuff that, you know, than they do Husker Du. But just like hearing his voice on it, you can kind of like draw that thread a little bit closer and go like, oh, okay. Like it's really clear how you get from A to B to C here. But anyways, that was just a random thought while I was doing it. But yeah, I'm on this song in particular, I'm super into it. Johnny, you got a take?
What Bob Mould album should I check out?
I feel like I can't remember what any of them are called right now. Hold on.
Well, you're looking that up. I guess.
Oh, okay. I think like I would start with Workbook from 1989. That's my favorite, but there's obviously.
I am somewhat deficient in both Husker Du and Bob Mould, so I will check those out and report back to you all.
Cool. Yeah. So anyways, people who are listening to this show, go watch this video. Even if you've avoided modern day Bob Mould stuff because you think he's just being a solo dad, this is quite fired up. So it's something you should go check out. Speaking of solo dad, Danbert No Bacon, your buddy.
Oh, my man, my homeboy.
Your homeboy. Anyway, so he of Chumbawamba fame, along with Kira Wood Kramer and the Axis of Descent, that's the name of their band, they are going to put out a new double album, which is called Mesmerica Expect a Circus, the digital version of which is out now. But the physical release, I guess, is pending. There is a video from the album and a song from the album streaming right now called Climate Emergency Parts 1 and 2, which you can go find on the internet. And John, so Danbert of pending Summer Soiree 4 fame has a new thing out. What's your take?
My take is Danbert is the man, and if people haven't checked out Chumbawamba, I mean all their stuff. Well, the first like everything from 1983 or like 1981 to like 1998 is like really good. But check out their first two proper albums, Pictures of Starving Children Sell Records, and oh my god, what's the second one? Never Mind the Ballads, the second album. You will notice a distinct correlation between those two albums and this new album. And you say, John, why that? The reason, because Danbert was one of the primary songwriters on that album. And in fact, Danbert and two others really formed Chumbawamba. Danbert and Boffo and Dunstan are the main guys in Chumbawamba. Well, they were the main guys in Chumbawamba. Chumbawamba kind of evolved beyond them, if you will. But like those, the first two Chumbawamba records are, they sound kind of like World Inferno. They're kind of like plays. And the new record, the new Danbert record, which I think the name of the band is a little long, but the new record itself is like Chumbawamba record number 3 that never was actually made. Like, it is really good. It's Danbert like doing his theatrical musical play type stuff. And it is like a surprisingly good record. I'm not like scared of clowns, but like I think clowns aren't particularly interesting. Well, it's not fun to look at clowns, so I think I would have chosen a different cover. You know, like the cover's got like a lot of grease paint on it, and I'm like, I don't think I want to look at this really. But other than so, I'm not. You know, the cover's the cover, but the record itself, which is important, is great. It's a double LP. I'm gonna buy the physical version when it comes out, and it is awesome when like an artist like still has their amazing talent that they had 30, 40 years ago, and they still have that same talent and are still able to make that same interesting art. And like I'm so glad that it's coming around full circle, maybe not in fame, but within skill and artistic level of excellence, this record is a really good record.
My son likes it. He was bopping along. That's my review.
I mean, I'm super into anyone that wants to sing about the climate right now. Like, we should all be thinking about that, like, every day. So I applaud that. The video did make me laugh a little bit for this. What was the song they did the video for?
Climate Emergency Parts 1 and 2.
Yeah. I mean, the video, what did you think of it, John? Because I felt like, you know, like, I understand we're all in, like, quarantine lockdown, and, like, everyone's got to get, like, really resourceful and, like, trying to figure out how to make music videos because they can't really be made in the normal way. But, like, this one, I thought, like sort of kept wobbling between, like, yeah, like, this sort of lockdown, like, resourcefulness and creativity, and then just, like, sort of, like, a hilarious, like, amateurness. What did you think when you were looking at it?
I agree with your synopsis. I thought it was funny that, like, there's Bratz dolls. And, hey, I want to know where Danbert got all these Bratz dolls from. You know, I'm like, well, you know. I think the video is cool. A understated aspect of Danbert, he's a super nice guy. He's a super smart guy. But he's also weird. Like, he's really weird. And, like when he plays live, like, sometimes he'll, like, act out a skit with puppets but have no puppets. Like, he'll, like, do the voices. And, like, I don't think people realize what he's doing. Like, he'll speak in one voice and then another and act like he's controlling puppets, but there's no puppets there. And so people, like, don't know what's going on. And that's kind of what's going on with it. But here he's got the puppet. Yeah, listen, Danbert is truly DIY. I mean, he is truly DIY. He was doing DIY before that was even he did DIY, not when it was an option, although it's kind of not an option again. Now it's a necessity. But he did DIY in the late 70s when it was the only route. And he's doing it here again. So it just goes to prove that his heart is where the art is. It's a cool video. I like the gothic and kind of scary aspect of the Bratz here. I think maybe the production value could have been a little bit better, but then again, does that matter? Maybe not. You know, climate change is what matters.
But didn't it make you giggle when sometimes, like, their mouths were moving and it was clear that he had taken footage from a different song and they weren't singing, like, the song that the video's for? I'm sorry. There were things about this that really tickled me.
I agree. What do they call that? They call that, like, art concrete or something like that, or plastic concrete. You know, it's he's a weird guy, Howie. What do you want me to say? He's a weird dude, you know?
Also, wait, listen, not to get too political about it, but, like, let's talk about the Bratz dolls, because they're talking about the climate crisis. And the video is the villains of this video are all these, like, Bratz and Barbie dolls. I don't know. There was something about it that I'm probably overthinking this. I'm sorry. But it did kind of bother me because it's a beauty image that has been sold to women that's not real, and there's something wrong with it. But, like, those dolls are images. They are women. It is women. And so it did bother me that they were the kind of the villains of this video, because I don't think we can, you know, I think most people can agree that the climate crisis, that the planet is being driven off a cliff by ugly, rich men, not by plastic, shallow, like, beautiful women. I don't think they're the ones that are, like, pushing the climate crisis forward. So, yeah, again, probably. Also, wait a minute, because also he reveals later in the video that he does also own male Barbie dolls. He had male Barbie dolls the whole time. He just chose to, like, sort of have the girls be, like, the bad guys. I don't know. There was something that bothered me about it, and I've really probably thought about this way too hard.
Well, listen, when we interview him next, we'll ask him about it. How about that?
Yes, I'd love to know what he was going for. Yes. And the homemade Trump doll. Oh, my God. The homemade Trump doll was great.
I only listened to the stream of this, and I feel like I really missed something now.
You really
missed something. You missed something, Adam. You missed something.
All right, we got we should play a song before we get to a few other things on the tail end here. Hallie, you want to play something?
Oh yeah, I really do. I'm so excited about the song I'm going to play. So this song is called, it's so good for this moment. This song is called Call the Cops. It's by a band called The Muslims, who are from Durham, North Carolina. They're an all queer black and brown Muslim punk band. That's how they describe themselves. And yeah, you know, like, I think, you know, this moment in history is making us all think about how we can better support black and brown people. And I've been thinking about that a lot also just as like a musician and a music lover. And I don't know, I think this band is awesome. And I would like, for myself, I'm just like, sort of have like a personal call to action where I'm going to just maybe seek out more music, more punk specifically by people of color, because I think there's a lot of really exciting stuff happening right now that I really do not have my finger on the pulse of, and like that would, I would probably really enjoy, and it would make me a smarter, better person. This is off the Muslims album it's called Gentrified Chicken. And this song is called Call the Cops, and it is so good.
Hi, everyone. What's the standard? Yeah, seriously. Okay, look. There's a super suspicious guy.
What's the race?
Well, he's out.
Oh, right.
All right, that was The Muslims. Very cool. Now we will move on to a few other little stories that we have going on here. John, what are we? Okay, this blank 77 story. What are we doing with this here? So the long running New Jersey Pogo Punks blank 77. They have entered the world of high fashion. The band is releasing a line of fingernail decals. I'm never sure how to say that word. Decals?
I don't know.
I've always said decals, but there was someone in my life that said decals at a certain point, and it's really fucked me up ever since I've heard that. Anyways, these are images that...
For years and years, my mom for years and years and years said coupon, and then she all of a sudden started saying coupon. I'm like, Mom, why are you saying coupon? It's coupon. And she's like, I always said it as coupon. I'm like, no, you didn't. But she refused to say that it used to be coupon. Otherwise, why else would I would say coupon instead of coupon?
Ah, well, all right, it's all John's mom's fault. Anyways, so these are, of course, images that will stay permanently affixed to long fingernails for stylish effects. So right now they released two sheets, and they may release more. John, what are we, the Punkies Podcast, supposed to do about this?
Well, I just think it's an amusing contrast because, A, one of the prime tenets of punk rock is it doesn't matter what you look like. It's what matters is who you are. But then on the other hand, punk is probably the most peacocked genre of music there is by any means, you know. And also, you know, Blank 77 is a somewhat regional but well-known within that region street punk band. They've been around for almost 30 years now. And they're known from like New York down to like Baltimore as like the street punk band. They're not as active as they used to be, but like they were kind of like one of the top street punk bands of the 90s. And in the 90s, there were a lot of street punk bands. And so, you know, street punk boozing, you know, being smelly, you know, having dirty clothes. I like that they're doing not necessarily high fashion, but amusing, you know, amusing accoutrements, which require maintenance and a high amount of cleanliness to use as part of one of their product lines. I just find it amusing, and I'm all for bands doing amusing things. And I will say, here's the point. You know, in punk rock, this has kind of faded away, but there still is some line is you shouldn't totally sell out. You know, like if you did a commercial for Blackwater, you know, or if the Trump re-election campaign wanted to give you $1 million, if you did that, you would be a sellout and would be lame to be a sellout. By contrast, it's kind of not lame to, like, you know, play a show for Pabst Blue Ribbon anymore because people are trying to get paid, you know, and I understand that. I do enjoy the concept that if it's funny enough, it doesn't count as selling out, which I like that rule.
Also, I don't think it can count as selling out because I don't think they're like making like money hand over fist with these decals.
Probably making like $12.
This amuses me to no end because, you know, like I, you know, didn't really know this band personally, but we did have a lot of mutual friends in the 90s. I do remember lots and lots of stories about them, like that they had gone on a tour where they had gotten scabies, and then anyone that got anywhere near their van on that entire tour also got scabies, so that they basically were just driving around the country giving everybody scabies. And if you had told me back then when I was hearing all these stories about them that one day they would be making like nail decals, I would not have believed it. But I'm with you, John. It's like, it's fun. Also, they're just like fun and funny people. So in a way, it does actually make sense because I could just see them being like, yeah, that's stupid. That's hilarious. We're doing that.
Yeah, I'm down. This is wonderfully silly. So I'm all for it. Yeah, I can't imagine. I mean, maybe we're wrong though if they're not making a lot of money. Like, is there not a ton of like street punk devotees that are out there that we don't hear about a lot because they isolate themselves from the rest of society, but they're just plunking down the cash.
I don't know if they're plunking down the cash, anytime I've thrown a show and street punk show up, they're like, oh, I don't have $8 to get in the show. Can I get in for $3? I'm like, you've got a $5.40 right there. Oh, my friend gave that to me. So I don't know if they're big spenders.
Oh, all right. What do I know? Okay. What else we got going on here? Mr. Bungle is back. The band has released their first new music in 21 years. It's a cover of The Exploited's USA. Sales of the digital single are going to benefit the MusiCare's COVID-19 relief fund. The 2020 version of Mr. Bungle includes Trevor Dunn, Mike Patton, Trey Sprunitz, Scott Ian of Anthrax, and Dave Lombardo, formerly of Slayer. So you can find this song streaming over at Bandcamp right now. John, Mr. Bungle thoughts?
I don't have a whole lot of thoughts on Mr. Bungle. I don't think I've ever actually listened to a full Mr. Bungle album. I thought this cover was cool. I think it's cool that Lombardo and Scott Ian are in the band. I think that's cool. But what surprised me is on the Punk News Facebook, this story was insanely popular, like insanely popular, like way more popular than against Me News or No Effects News. So I guess all our readers love Mr. Bungle or something.
There are like Mike Patton devotees out there. Maybe there's just more of them than we thought. I don't know.
I was just surprised at how popular this story, like you don't really hear about Mike Patton that much in like the media, but I know he's got mega fans, but I didn't realize he had mega fans at Punk News. I've never really checked out Faith No More too much. I mean, I've heard some songs. I've probably heard some albums. I don't think I've ever listened to Mr. Bungle album all the way through. And he's got another band that is one of his main bands, so I forget which. And then he's got a million projects. But Hallie, Mr. Bungle, are you like the biggest fan in the world, or what's the deal?
Wouldn't you be so surprised and happy if I was like hugely into Mr. Bungle? I can't say that I am. I never got into Mr. Bungle. Also, this falls into the category you were describing, John, of I feel like that that definitive Mr. Bungle album had like really unfortunate clown art on the cover. That was like part of why I totally could not get into it. It had like a really disturbing clown face on it. And I was like, yeah, that's not for me. Also, the guys I knew that were into Mr. Bungle were a little annoying. And that was that those were deal breakers for me and just never got into it.
I think, see, everybody has the same exact story, but somehow they're really popular.
Well, do you remember, like, in the early 2000s when Mike Patton did that record with the Dillinger Escape Plan, and everyone treated it like it was the, like, it was just the convergence of all of music's power and potential into one thing. Like, people went absolutely insane about that record when it came out. And I just remember I was way too, like, young into my extreme music listening career to think it was anything but scary, but people were just crazy. So maybe there's like just some magic that follows Mike Patton around and just demands attention. So a few other little stories that we want to talk about this week, all of which have interesting social issues that they play off of here. So the first one here is that One Little Indian Records is now One Little Independent Records. So One Little Indian Records was founded by Derek Burkett of the UK anarcho-punks Flux of Pink Indians. It is, I think, very famously the label that released things from Crass and Bjork. I think it's what released everything from Bjork up until now.
Maybe. Of course, Crass Records famously released the first Bjork album, Kugel.
Right. So they're, but just like, and also from your buddies, Chumbawamba, of course, stuff from Flux of Pink Indians. Super into the Avant and the anarcho punk scene. So anyway, so One Little Indian Records, they've changed their name to One Little Independent Records. They are also making donations to organizations such as the Honoring Indigenous Peoples Charitable Corporation and the Association on American Indian Affairs. They released a statement. I'm just trying to, where is it here? Oh, sorry. The decision came because they got a letter from a Crass fan when they were doing their Crass reissues. And he said that Burkett said that he had read the letter and he immediately started making arrangements to stop using the One Little Indian Records name and logo through our digital properties, and they're in the process of changing the name right now. And that's it. The label has been renamed. In his statement, he said, "The last few weeks have been a monumental learning curve. Following the receipt of one eye-opening letter from a Crass fan that detailed precisely why the logo and name were offensive, as long as the violent history of the terminology, I felt equally appalled and grateful to them for helping me understand what must be changed. As a teenager living in London in the late 1970s, my friends and I were deeply inspired when we learned about some of the philosophies of the Indigenous peoples of the Americas, of peace and love for each other and for nature and the planet. And in turn, they were a huge influence in our anarchist punk movement. I was naive enough at the time of the founding of my label to think that the name and logo were reflective of my respect and appreciation of the culture." He goes on to explain that, you know, his white privilege prevented him from really realizing the potential harm that was being done there, and trying to make things better now. So you can find the full statement over on Punk News. I don't want to minimize it, but I don't want to sit here and read to you either. So that has happened. John, what's do you have a take, or is this just a notable brand in your circle?
Yeah, I've got a hot take, unfortunately, on this. In that, the album name comes from Flux of Pink Indians. At the time, the term Indian wasn't seen by most people as an offensive term. As we learned in the 80s and 90s, that kind of is an offensive term because it's inaccurate and it generalizes a group of people that necessarily shouldn't be generalized in that context. And Native American or First Nations is a much better term. And I agree with that 100%. And I definitely agree that he should change the name of the label. And I think it's good that he changed the name of the label because, you know, the name, you know, that word isn't kind of cool anymore. It was never cool. But, you know, when it's definitely not cool now. But when Flux of Pink Indies was created and when One Little Indian Records was created, it wasn't as widespread or as well understood, or and people weren't as educated that, that kind of is an offensive term. So I don't think like I don't think you could say at the time when he founded the band or the record label that he was being or that he knew he was being offensive. And so, yes, it's time to change the name of the label, and it's good that he did. I think he apologizes a little bit too much in that, like, he's like, I could never understand the amount of violence that I've done. I don't think so. I mean, the record label famously has supported many underrepresented and minority bands of all genders, of all races, of all sexualities. So these are the good guys. And one thing that I think that the left kind of does too much is they get down on themselves too much. And that not only lets other people from the left kind of kick down on them to make themselves feel better about themselves, but it also gives the right an area to attack, you know, like Trump or whoever will say the most racist thing. But then if someone on the left makes it an innocent mistake, and they say, oh, I'm such a horrible person, then the right attacks on that and says, yes, you are a horrible person. See, you're bad, bad, bad. So I think he over-apologizes, and I think there is such a thing as apologizing too much. And this is a minor quibble. I think a better response would have been like, listen, when we formed the label, we weren't trying to be offensive. By now, we understand that it is kind of offensive or it is offensive, so we're going to change the label, and that's that. I think he apologizes too much. I don't think he needs to get down on his knees and beg for forgiveness like he kind of is. And well, also is – well, I don't get it. We could talk about this for 45 minutes. The point being is I don't think he needs to – I don't think he's really done anything that bad. And I think it's time to change the label. And I think he acted appropriately. So I don't think you need to apologize for acting appropriately, which I think is what he's doing here.
I wonder what was said in the letter, like what the details were of the letter. Like the story is just reminding me of an interview that I heard with Hank Azaria when he about his choice not to do the voice of Apu on The Simpsons anymore. And he said like for years that like he had just really not understood why it upset people. You know, he felt like he did a lot of voices and this was just one of them. And he was an actor and that was his job to like create a character. And he did feel like he had like, you know, tried to like make this character like a real, but he had, you know, but it was like, he got a letter from someone that was like, I think he got probably several letters from people that were like, yeah, I got called Apu as a kid from people that like wanted to diminish me, and it was like super hurtful, and like, and he, it was like it took him a while to absorb it. So I'm just wondering if there was something of what was said in the letter to this guy that made him feel like he needed to apologize on that level, or like some other, I don't know. But I think in general, when you feel like you might have done something that hurt people, I don't know, what's the harm in going hog wild with your apology? You know what I mean? Like, why not just really apologize? You know, like as people that are on the left, like I do feel like we a little bit have to like lead by example, because, you know, our we get so upset when people on the right just like refuse to apologize for this kind of stuff, or like stuff that they've done that like hurt people, whether they intended it to or not. It's like, you need to like make amends. You do need to make amends if you've hurt people. So I don't know. Anyhow, those are my thoughts.
I'll leave it at that. I don't really have anything that I intend to add to that. And everyone's heard me talk enough. So we'll do one more here. This is a long show. We're going to do one more before John,
a long show
before John talks about the Melvins here. And whereas the label that we just talked about did something good for the world, here's a company that does bad things for the world, and it's Facebook. And so Facebook, despite steadfast refusing to deal with all of Trump's bullshit, has decided that they are going to use their efforts to run around and try to ban accounts that are linked to the word skinhead.
Specials.
Yeah. So they did this with an algorithm, which means they threw some developers at it instead of actually having people look at it. And I say that as a developer, you shouldn't have us try to solve your social problems. So they threw some algorithms at it, and what they ended up with was they banned a bunch of stuff that had to do with non-racist skinheads, including a bunch of stuff that had to do with Jamaican culture and ska music and places where skins show up innocently. And amusingly, they also banned the account of Neville Staple of the Specials. So they have unbanned the account of Neville, but for a little while he was swept up in Facebook's big attempt to to do something about the problem that is not the problem that they should really be focusing on, to editorialize a little bit. John, what's our read? This is funny on one hand, Facebook is stupid on the other. So do we confirm this?
I actually think the general content of Facebook is, well, minus all the tracking you and keeping records of everything you do, but the idea that you can go on and talk with your friends and do event posts, I love the idea of Facebook, but it's got a lot of garbage on it now, man. And I don't think you can solve that through algorithms, Facebook is a private company. They can do what they want. I don't know if I want anybody limiting what I can or cannot say. But on the other hand, you got to draw the line somewhere, and Nazis is bullshit. But then how come, I guess just Facebook, how come they're not actually getting rid of the Nazis and they're getting rid of poor Neville? They just don't know what they're doing. And honestly, I guess they're too wimpy to really take a stand on things that matter and can really affect people. So they kind of take a half-ass approach like this, which backfires and doesn't really make any real difference. I used to think that companies will do whatever they want to do, and like Ticketmaster, they'll do whatever they want to do, and people will complain, but people have lives, and so people will kind of forget about it, and the companies will survive and just be fine. I'm somewhat glad to see that Facebook is suffering, and Facebook is getting kind of beat by Twitter and Instagram, and those have their own issues too. But I think Facebook is suffering from their own indifference and not caring about – well, actually, I am mad at Facebook that I think about it. What with regard to all the election BS that they allowed to happen and all the Russian bots and stuff. So screw Facebook. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that was
not only –
it was this story that seems like, hey, I mean, now I am entirely okay with a private company deciding that they're going to expunge Nazis from their, off their front lawn like that. You're a private company. You can do what you want with that. Despite the fact that you are important to a lot of people, you are not the public square. So I don't really expect a private company to necessarily have to uphold everyone's perfect ideals of free speech or anything like that, because Facebook's not stopping you from standing on a street corner being a Nazi, but they're totally allowed to stop you from being on Facebook being a Nazi. At least that's my un-American read on that. But to see them just go do something stupid like this, or and stupid is the right word for it, right? Where to just sort of like boneheadedly stumble around and accidentally ban ska bands during the same like couple of weeks where Zuckerberg is taking like these completely tone deaf public statements that he's put out about why he just can't censor Trump when Trump says something that is dangerously misleading or inciting violence or anything like that. Like, why Twitter can slap Trump across the wrist for that stuff, but Facebook just says it's impossible. But it's impossible to do that, but it's not impossible to run around and write, things that are targeting non-racist skinheads. It seems ridiculous to me. It's like, it speaks to the general tone deafness of Facebook's management to be able to actually handle the outsized role in society that they've carved for themselves. So, yeah. where I'm going.
I think Facebook is the worst. It's awful. Facebook is the enemy. I don't think I'm going to just go out there and say, I don't think punks should be even on Facebook. I think Neville should have thrown a freaking party that Facebook kicked him off. And I think he should have asked for his thing not to be reinstated. And that's my hot take.
Hallie, you don't like Facebook because of its core concept, or you don't like Facebook because it clearly is an evil, greedy company?
No, I mean, I'm with you, John. I mean, I think you can absolutely point to Facebook for getting us in the mess we're in with this.
Yeah, COVID. Okay, yeah.
And you know, it's like, yeah, it's I feel like I've talked a lot of politics already, so I'll leave it at that. But I think Facebook is just sheerly bad. I think it's bad.
Here's the problem, and this is, like I love the event function on Facebook is great, like letting people know about events. Like Twitter and Instagram doesn't have that, you know. I wish they did.
That is like the one thing that is like is the sticky thing that I think once it is solved, I think you're going to see a big exodus of like the music world, because like that to me, like that's the only thing that keeps Facebook in my circle is that like, oh well, I kind of need it for, you know, like knowing what shows are coming up and things like that. And if they could like decouple that event calendar from it, it becomes way less sticky for me, because there isn't anything that I use it for that I couldn't use some other tool for at that point. But for events, yeah. You kind of need to be where the people are. Like you can't just go make the same. You can't just go to like meetup.com and list your show and expect that anyone's necessarily going to see it. Right. So, you know, whoever's going to solve that problem is going to be the,
I think Instagram should solve that.
Yeah. But that's Facebook.
Like Instagram.
But Instagram hasn't been used and manipulated by bad actors in the way that Facebook has, you know? And
yeah, I mean, so yeah, it's
the money is going to the same place, but I do think on principle, maybe you can, like, at least I can justify still being on Instagram
I can compartmentalize it as well. It's just that, like, if I'm looking for someone to ride in on a white horse and solve this problem, then I'd like that to be someone else.
Yeah, like Bandcamp. I don't know.
Bandcamp should solve it.
Yeah. How you solved it? Bandcamp is the best place for something like that. That really is.
Yeah, I think so too. I do think people need to start exiting that platform en masse, but that's just me.
That'd be like on Bandcamp, you can follow bands and then you can eat, like, we're doing a show. Here's the event book page on Bandcamp. Mm-hmm. You know, buy a record before you come. That's a good answer.
Yeah. I mean, I do get messages from bands that I follow on Bandcamp, but you're right. It's not about events. It'll be about a release, or it'll be about, you know, yeah, other stuff. This has to be solvable.
Yeah. Yeah. If we can split the atom, we can solve the online event situation.
Well, there we go. There's also some Melvin's news, but who cares, right?
Next week. There's always Melvin.
Oh, you're letting me bump Melvin's news? Ooh.
The Melvins and Mudhoney are putting out a collaborative EP. The Melvins have been on a roll. They've been putting out a lot of collaborative EPs, and they've just been throwing stuff at the wall. Well, actually, they would say they're being very tactical, which I agree. I'm very excited for this EP, particularly because the first track is My War. So I hope it's the Black Flag cover of My War. Interestingly, Buzz Osborne released an EP about 4 months ago, and the first track was a cover of Six Pack. I hope it's Buzz Osborne, not Mark Arm singing, just because I'm more of a Melvin fan than I'm a Mudhoney fan. But I'll accept what I get. The Melvins have been on a roll. I'm digging how they're being experimental in their lineups and different lineups every record. It's cool. The Melvins rule. If you are a mid-level band or even a small band and you want a guidance on how to make your band a successful band post-COVID-19, that is, follow the guide of the Melvins. They just perennially kick ass.
John loves Melvins.
Melvins.
Yeah, that's where we go with that. John, are you going to play any audio before we get to episode 500, which is definitely next week?
I would skip it because it's been a long episode. No, I actually enjoyed this episode quite a bit, but I don't know if Hallie and Adam are worn out or as engaged as I am. But the point being is I would skip it because next week is episode 500. I'm going to play one of two songs, and Hallie and Adam, I will let you decide. One of the themes on the Punk News podcast is John goes to a record store, finds a weird, rare record, buys it, takes it home, and it is great. Well, this week I'm going to play either a weird, rare, obscure record that I got at the record store, took home and played, and turned out to be very good, or I am going to play a record that I bought from a record store because it looked weird and rare. I took it home and I played it, and it was terrible. Which one do you guys want to hear?
Adam, what's your vote?
Well, you know what? It's the end of the show. If you're really going to tick people off, they can just stop. So do the terrible. Terrible one.
So you know, on the Punk News podcast, I'm always like, I got this record and it's great, but that's because we don't tell you about the failure stories. We only tell you about the success stories. So here's a failure story: is I was at the record store, and I think I don't think it was in the dollar bin. I might have got this out of the dollar bin, but it might have been the four for one day, so it was only a quarter. And it was a record called Holiday Rap, and it had like a beach scene on the front. I'm like, Holiday Rap with a beach? I buy this record. I'm going to check it out. It was by a guy called MC Mickey and DJ Sven. And I'm like, this is going to be great. So I take it home and I play, and it's literally just Madonna's Holiday instrumental with two guys from the Netherlands ripping rhymes off the Sugar Hill Gang and rapping over the top. And then they also do like midway through that song, I'm going on a holiday to London, New York. Will you come with me? Except for they do the Yellow Man version of all things. So they're like ripping off Sugar Hill Gang and Yellow Man. And it's bad. It's bad. It's really bad. And it's really cheesy. I did enjoy that they say we're going to London, New York, but we take a little piece of Amsterdam. Because everyone knows I love Netherlands, but as much as I love Netherlands, I can't recommend this record. That being said, as it turned out, this record is credited at starting the UK, the European house scene in Europe. This record is like the jam. This is considered like the biggest record in the Europe house scene ever. It kicked off the European house scene, and I'm like, it's just two guys rapping over Madonna's Holiday. So, Punk News podcast listeners, you decide. Awesome. Or crappy.
Celebrate several weeks, my good GS, when we took the holiday with all our friends. It was a time to relax and let you wear it behind. Exactly several weeks, but something crossed my mind. It was the sign of the time we never forget. One morning, our parents kicked us out of our bed. We told them, Mr. Stupid, don't play the fool. But the answer was shut, you got to go to school.
G's running up and down, and everybody know. Rapping, rocking, popping in the street, kid show. Mike, G rock the house, and you know what I'm saying. Now, when he's on a mic, there will be no delay. So you better run to see him in your neighborhood. He's rapping, rocking all the way to Hollywood. Hey, check it out, these are the words we say. Yo, scream at us, we need a holiday. We're gonna ring a rang a dong for the holiday.
Put your arms in the air, let me hear you say.
We're gonna ring rang a dong for a holiday.
Put your arms in the air, let me hear you say.
We're gonna ring rang a dong for a holiday.
Mike and D and Sven, we're here to stay.
We're gonna ring rang a dong for a holiday.
Hey, check out the new style we just played.
We are going on a summer holiday. If you want to go, you're Sven. We go into London and New York City, and we take a little piece of Amsterdam, right? We are going on a summer holiday. If you want to go, you're Sven. We go into London and New York City, and we take a little piece of Amsterdam, right?
I want a holiday, I've screwed a lot. The only thing in school, the only thing I've got. That's where Sparrow told me, I better go. That's when hanging on the street, in the street, get show. Ain't about rocks, what happened to you? I told them it's my life, and I know what I'm doing. I started at school, I thought I'd never stay. Give me 7 weeks again, I need my holiday.
Well, this is my partner with the number one jam. Famous in the Boogie Bronx and Amsterdam. He's the fastest rapper, yo, the name is Micah G. His rap is stronger than the soccer MC. Well, let me show you what my man can do. Rapping, rocking, popping, and the boogaloo too. But anyway, no more delay. Just listen to the beatbox he will play.
My name is
You like the Micah G, so I use my voice. As soon as the guys did the big Rolls Royce. That's right, my name is Micah G. I use the holiday with the F-I-C. On the street was a party bigger than Hollywood. I grew up in this world, started in the neighborhood.
We're gonna ring rang-a-dong for a holiday.
Put your arms in the air, let me hear you say.
We're gonna ring rang-a-dong for a holiday.
I put your arms in the air, let me hear you say.
We're gonna ring rang-a-dong for a holiday.
Micah G and Sweat, we're here to stay.
We're gonna ring rang-a-dong for a holiday.
Hey, check out the new style we just played.
We are going on a summer holiday. If you want to go, you're swim. We go into London and New York City, and we take a little piece of Amsterdam,
right?
We are going on a summer holiday. If you want to go, you're swim. We go into London and New York City, and we take a little piece of Amsterdam.
Micah G and Sweat. Well, we got more girls than a school count stand. Making music, rapping, rocking all night long. So point your ears and listen to this song. There's nothing better than a sunny holiday. We start in June and ends in May. We ain't fooling around with no stupid play. The only thing we need is a holiday. We're gonna ring rang-a-dong for a holiday.
Put your arms in the air, let me hear you say.
We're gonna ring rang-a-dong for a holiday.
Hey, check out the new style we just played. Oh! I can see ya,
but I can hear ya, and you know that.
Yeah.
We are going on a summer holiday. If you want to go, you'll swim. We go into London and New York City, and we take a little piece of Amsterdam.
Right.
We are going on a summer holiday. If you want to go, you'll swim. We go into London and New York City, and we take a little piece of Amsterdam. We are going on a summer holiday. If you want to go, you'll swim. We go into London and New York City, and we take a little piece of Amsterdam.
Right.
We are going on a summer holiday. If you want to go, you'll swim. We go into London and New York City, and we take a little piece of Amsterdam.
Bike is a thing most rappers do. Yo, I can ride my own shit too. I can understand things most rappers say, because rapping is my thing and I do it every day. I'm the number one rapper, yo, my name is Sven. I can rap more raps than a Superman can. So I'm the guy on your radio, also rocking to the rhythm in stereo.
And you don't stop, for that body rock. You won't stop, for that body rock. Yo, spell my name right, I'm Micah G. M-I-K-E-R-N-G-U-C. Yo, M is microphone and G is genius. Micah G in the house, that's serious. And you know that, and you show that. It's time, Sven, so let's go back.
City. We are going on a summer holiday. We go into London and New York City.